If you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. It's 1 o'clock. A summary of the news now. The Department for Work and Pensions says it will fight any attempt by bishops in the House of Lords to overturn government plans to cap increases in welfare payments. The new Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has backed an open letter by more than 40 bishops who say the measure will drive families and children into poverty. They've tabled an amendment to the welfare bill, which is due to be debated in the Lords next week. Nick Clegg has suffered a defeat at the Liberal Democrat Spring Conference in Brighton, which has overwhelmingly opposed legislation to allow evidence in some civil court cases to be heard in secret. One party activist, a lawyer, Jo Shaw, said she was resigning her membership in protest at the plans. In the past hour, Mr. Clegg has been delivering his main speech to the conference. He urged the Lib Dems to build on the success of the Eastleigh by-election, saying they had secured victory as a party of government, not a party of protest. The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, has accused the Taliban and the US government of working together to convince Afghans violence will increase if most foreign troops leave as planned at the end of next year. He said recent suicide attacks, which the Taliban said they'd carried out, were aimed at prolonging the international military presence in Afghanistan. Police in the Pakistani city of Lahore say they've arrested dozens of people after more than 100 homes in a Christian neighbourhood were ransacked and set on fire yesterday. The trouble began after it was alleged that a Christian man had made blasphemous remarks about the Prophet Muhammad. There have been demonstrations against the attacks in Lahore and in the capital, Islamabad. The polls have opened in the Falkland Islands, where people are voting in a referendum on whether the territory should remain British. The islanders decided to hold the vote in response to Argentine pressure for negotiations over sovereignty. And the weather, sleet and snow in central areas will spread southwards this afternoon. It'll be generally windy and very cold. BBC News and weather at just after 2 minutes past one. Well, now on Radio 3, our Baroque spring season continues with the early music show's French Baroque focus. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Towards the end of his life, Jean-Philippe Rameau would leave his large suite of rooms in Rue des Bons Enfants every day to take a walk in the nearby gardens of the Palais Royal, or Tuileries. He was always alone and usually lost in thought. Sometimes he would meet the young writer Chabanon, who later noted down some of the old composer's disillusioned, confidential remarks. "Day by day, I'm acquiring more good taste," Rameau is reported to have said, "but I no longer have any genius." That's quite surprising to hear, because we know that Rameau's late years were actually very successful and productive, and a period in his life which coincided with his meeting his most important patron, Alexandre le Riche de la Pouplinière.
Thank you.
Chaconne from Rameau's opera or Tragédie en musique, Castor et Pollux, performed there by Les Talents Lyriques, conducted by Christophe Rousset. It was preceded there by the voice of Véronique Jean with a moving rendition of what's probably the work's most famous aria, Triste Après, the mourning song of the princess when she hears of the death in battle of her beloved Castor. The opera was given in 1737 at Paris's Académie Royale de Musique. Rameau was now in his mid-50s and a mere 5 years into what can be seen as an entirely new direction in his career. He'd spent much of the first part of his life as a theorist of music. Some even called him a dry old stick. But now he was fixing his sights on composing for the stage. And the man they called La Pouplinière was there to help him and support him. La Pouplinière was a wealthy financier and one of the 18th century's greatest patrons of the arts. A true figure of the Enlightenment, he gathered around him a circle of talented and intellectual men who met in his luxurious apartment in a fashionable Paris suburb. He also had his own private orchestra and theatre. And it's been suggested that in this exclusive company, the first performance of Rameau's first opera was given, Hippolyte et Arisée. The work caused an enormous fuss. Until then, the closest Rameau had come to writing dramatic music was a few secular cantatas and some popular pieces for the Paris fairs. Supporters of Lully claimed the opera was Italianate and Baroque, which was a derogatory term at the time. An assault, they said, on the French musical tradition. Others loved it, though, calling Rameau the Orpheus of our century. And the composer Compre remarked, "This man will surely eclipse us all." The story of the opera concerns the Greek hero Theseus, his wife Phaedra, and Theseus's son Hippolytus, who's in love with Arisia. At this point in the fourth act, Hippolytus has been killed by a sea monster. The distraught Phaedra realises she's been the cause of his death. "I have spilt innocent blood. What remorse? Where can I hide? Hades opens up beneath my feet."
Oh,
and Sophie Fonotta as Phaedra and Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie, with Quelle plante en ces lieux m'appelle from Rameau's opera Hippolyte, which received its first public performance in 1733. It may have been at Poupliniere's home. Certainly it was around this time that the great financier began to take a serious interest in Rameau and hired him as his composer in residence to direct his private orchestra. Rameau benefited enormously, not only in terms of financial security, of course, but also from the rich artistic environment he found on this grand estate. In fact, it may have been La Poupliniere's mistress, Thérèse Des-Haies, who introduced the composer to his patron. She was a devoted keyboard pupil of Rameau and one of his most enthusiastic champions. We don't know how good a player she was, but it's nice to imagine she may have tackled pieces like these. Two delightful and rather intriguing little minuets from Rameau's Pièce de Clavecin. Noël Speet there with Minuets 1 and 2 from the Deuxième Concert, part of Rameau's set of Pièces de Clavecin, published in 1741. Rameau's association with La Pouplinière lasted almost 20 years and was incredibly significant in the shaping of his career. The financier's home was a meeting place for all classes, courtiers, men of the world, literary folk, artists, foreigners, actors, actresses, not to mention ladies of a certain kind. All of them assembled there. The house was affectionately dubbed the Menagerie and the host, the Sultan. What we don't know are what exactly were the terms of Rameau's appointment, or even before 1751, the size and makeup of the orchestra that he was in charge of. It is clear, though, that La Pouplinière's musical establishment grew from strength to strength as he incorporated new players. And then there were the singers and dancers from the Paris Opera who were frequent dinner guests and took part in concerts and theatrical entertainments. Meanwhile, in the summer of 1735, Rameau produced Les Indes Galantes. It was a huge success, given no less than 67 performances, and in the lighter style of an opera ballet. Its series of delightful instrumental symphonies, each of them full of character, form the suite that we're going to hear now. There's a dance of lovers, another a dance of African slaves, a storm scene, tambourine dances, and to start, music depicting soldiers with their flags of war.
Thank you.
A suite of dances from Rameau's opera Les Indes Galantes, Les Concerts des Nations, directed by Jordi Savall. It's nice to hear that gradually Rameau's relationship with his grand employer became not just one of business, but a real friendship too. La Pouplinière eventually married his mistress Thérèse, and she and her husband agreed to be godparents to Rameau's third child, born in 1740, and in return, Rameau honoured his patron by naming one of his pieces after him, with the title La Pouplinière. Mind you, just how much the music really portrays the great man's character, we can't be sure. But if we're to believe the whimsical twists on the harpsichord and the little emphatic fermatas, then perhaps we might imagine that La Pouplinière was a little bit fickle and unstable at times, and perhaps a little bit mischievous too.
Thank you.
a piece by Rameau, La La Pouplinière, named after his wealthy patron. Robert Koenen was the harpsichordist, Barthold Kuchen on flute, violinist Sigisfeld Kuchen, and on viol de gamba, Wieland Kuchen. So what exactly was Rameau like? Well, his student Chabanon noted how extremely tall he was. Lean and scraggy, he wrote, with more the air of a ghost than a man. Rameau was also unusually shy, slightly eccentric, and quite a difficult man to get to know. But this didn't seem to stop him networking and making useful connections with the constant stream of artists he met at La Pouplinière's home, collaborators whom perhaps he wouldn't have had the character to introduce himself to otherwise. Amongst them was Voltaire, and the two soon began working together. Frustratingly, their first project, the tragedy on Musique Samson, had to be abandoned. Voltaire was a notorious critic of the church, and anything on a religious theme risked being banned by the authorities. The two of them did, however, go on to collaborate on Les Surprises de l'Amour. And in 1745, they jointly produced the opera ballet Le Temple de la Gloire and the comedy ballet La Princesse de Navarre. The end of Act Two of Rameau's The Princess of Navarre with libretto by Voltaire. That was the English Baroque Festival Singers and Baroque Orchestra conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. It was a spectacular production by all accounts, involving no less than 180 extras. And most importantly, it was a critical success. And yet Voltaire found Rameau hard to work with, demanding and critical. "Poor Rameau is mad," he declared. "He's as great an eccentric as he is a musician." By this time, though, Rameau was becoming well known outside the confines of La Pouplinière's estate. His commission to compose The Princess of Navarre had come from the French court for the marriage of the Dauphin, and several more commissions followed from the royal household, along with invitations from the Paris Opera. What's more, Rameau may not have ever been one of the king's official musicians, but he was granted the title Compositeur du Cabinet du Roi, along with a substantial pension. Rameau's close connection with his patron could at times lead to artistic choices. La Pouplinière had cultivated musical tastes. He knew what he liked, you could say. And when he began importing virtuoso players of the clarinet and the horn from Germany and Bohemia, instruments that were then quite new to France, Rameau became the first composer to use them at the Paris Opera. Let's hear one of his most exciting and dramatic operatic scenes now. It's from the Zoroastra, which was first staged in December 1749 and may possibly be the very first work to use the clarinet in France. The story concerns the ancient kingdom of Bactria and the struggle between the forces of good and evil. All is in chaos after the death of the king. His two daughters are both in love with Zoroastra, and the evil sorcerer Abraman plans to seize the throne. He sends his rival into exile, and here at the end of Act One, uses his magic to make the ground open up, and he sends his demons to capture the princess. "Gods, protectors of innocence, defend me," she calls out as she's carried off by hell's furies.
Thank you.
the dramatic climax of Act One of Rameau's opera Zoroaster. The two warring princesses were sung by Gaëlle Méchaly and Anna Maria Panzarella, with Les Arts Florissants directed by William Christie. It was certainly a comfortable and fruitful association between Rameau and his patron, which lasted for nearly two decades. Even after the financier separated from his wife, the composer and Madame Rameau had stayed on, spending each summer at his country home in Passy, and even living for a time in an apartment at his patron's Paris residence. But in 1753, things were brought to an end. La Pouplinière's newest mistress moved in, and soon made life unbearable for the Rameaus. She was something of a musician herself, and it may have been under her influence that the rich financier decided to replace his venerable 70-year-old musical director with a more fashionable one, in the shape of Johann Stamitz. Of course, it's likely that by this stage Rameau was already so well established that he probably no longer needed his patron anyway. Nevertheless, after the split, his composing seemed to dry up. He wrote fewer and fewer works, throwing himself instead into finishing his theoretical writings. A rare glimpse of the aged composer is revealed in his letter of November 1763 to the businessman Casaubon. He begins by apologising for having seen Brusque, and even insulting in a previous letter, but explains that his time is now very precious to him if he is to complete all his discoveries. He also writes of a lack of brain power and of eyesight, and how he cannot concentrate nowadays more than 2 hours during the daytime. Rameau, then, was slowing down, and, as we heard at the beginning of today's programme, could be found every day taking the air around the Palais Royal or the Tuileries, lost in thought. Perhaps the split with the man who'd supported him so very much in his finest years had affected him more than he let on, or maybe he just felt sort of creatively burnt out. "The imagination is worn out in my old head," Rameau's quoted as saying. "It's not wise at this age to want to practice arts that are nothing but imagination." Rameau died, leaving a final tragédie en musique, Les Boréades. We don't know why it wasn't produced at the time. In fact, it had to wait until the late 20th century for a proper staging. I can't help feeling that had Rameau still been with La Pouplinière when he died, that the financier would have found a way of staging it himself. Thank you.
part of Jean-Philippe Rameau's Les Boréades suite for orchestra. And it ends today's early music show. Le Concert des Nations were conducted by Jordi Savall, and the programme was presented by Lucy Skeeping. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM. We're on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 2 o'clock and now Baroque Spring, live from Powis Castle, where we join Katie Derham.
And welcome to Powis Castle in Mid Wales for this second of our live Sunday afternoon concerts for Baroque Spring, given in association with the National Trust in some of their fabulous Baroque properties. Today we are in the ballroom of this quite splendid castle, looking out over the Severn Valley from our imposing perch, with the terraced gardens cascading down several hundred feet below us, surrounded by tapestries and paintings of this mid-18th century ballroom, which must have witnessed some pretty spectacular music making over the centuries. The castle itself, in the heart of the Welsh Marches, dates back to the mid-1200s, but during the interval, you'll be able to hear more about the truly wonderful suite of Baroque rooms, which I explored earlier with the Antiques Roadshow's Lars Tharp and the castle's National Trust steward, William Brown. Indeed, if you go to the Radio 3 website, you can see a short film of our discoveries. Now, those rooms, particularly, well, in fact, almost completely unchanged today, were the creation of the first Marquess of Powis, William Herbert, who, as a devout Catholic during the reigns of Charles II and Charles's brother James II, found himself in the clutches of a national crisis. When James gave up the throne in 1688 following the Glorious Revolution and the Protestant William of Orange ruled with his wife Mary, William Herbert decided to follow James II into exile in France at the wonderful Palace of Saint-Germain-en-Laye, just beyond the boundaries of Paris. There, James's court would encounter the artistic splendours of James's cousin, Louis XIV, and that is the starting point for today's programme of music. It's been devised by this afternoon's performers, the award-winning group Le Jardin Secret. They've called it In Splendid Disgrace, music of solace and consolation for an exiled king. Now, this is not music about the exile, but music that would have been fashionable in the French court and at Saint-Germain during this time, and it forms a perfect reflection of the prevalent taste of the French Baroque during the latter half of the 17th and early part of the 18th centuries. So now, in this wonderful setting of Powis Castle, let us just let the music transport us back some 300 years to savour some of the moods and sentiments of Baroque France. First of all, we're going to hear Ad un cuore from L'Europe galante by André Campra, performed by all the members of Le Jardin Secret.